Good morning. Happy Palm Sunday to you. If anyone gives breakdancing lessons, please see Mark after church today. We have been in this series we've been calling the Great Experiment. And just by way of reminder to you, Lent is not a Protestant thing or a Catholic thing. It's the way that our early church fathers chose to take the 40 days prior to Easter to prepare their hearts to live out of the power of the crucifixion and the resurrection. And so for us, over these last 40 days, we've been looking at the core values, the things that we say come right out of Scripture that for us as a church we own as much as anything else. So our 40 days ends on Friday, so I hope you've been tracking. We've been making what we call, we've been giving up, making eternal investments. So I hope you've been involved in that process, and we'll see that through until Friday. Now, of all the core values that we've talked about, there have been five of them for our church. Of all of them that we're gonna that we've talked about, I think today is the one that we have. We're probably most likely to get distracted when it comes to our core value. This is the one we call it global responsibility. It's about thinking outwardly rather than just thinking inwardly. And it's so easy for us because of the pace of our lives and because of all the stuff that we do or we say we have to do to get distracted and to start focusing on us instead of others. And there are numerous kinds of distractions. You know, a couple months ago on Monday morning, I had to catch a flight out of the airport over on the east side. And so, you know, when you do that, sometimes you just try to pack too much in. And so I thought, man, I can get to the gym kind of uber early and sneak a quick workout in and then get to the airport. And that's what I tried to do. And it was late, right? And you got to get there. You got to catch the shuttle. So I've got my backpack. I've got my roll-on, you know, car or a little baggage thing with me. I'm not checking a bag. And so I get there and I'm behind. But I get to security and, you know, I made it through like, man, it was quick. And so I've actually got a couple of extra minutes. And so I get to the other side of security, and there's Starbucks right there in front of me. So I think, this is a sign from God. I should stop at Starbucks this morning. So I stop and get an Americano. And I thought, you know, I worked out this morning. I'm going to treat myself. I'm going to get a blueberry muffin. So I get a blueberry muffin, and it was warm. Like they just baked it. I'm sure they didn't, but it just made me feel this warm muffin and some coffee. And I'm excited. I get my backpack, and I realize, man, I'm running tight on time now, so I've got to get down to the gate. So I go down to the gate, and they've already given the first call for passengers, you know, who need special assistance, and all the first-class people are standing up there waiting to get on the plane. Listen, if you fly first class, I don't have anything against you. Or maybe I do. I don't know. It's just, you know, whenever you get on the plane and all the first class people are already sitting there and they're eating like their 8-ounce Hyde Park filet with their Cheesecake Factory dessert, watching their own individual movie on their 60-inch, you know, TV monitor that they've got in front of them. And all that's okay. That's fine. Right. But it's just the way the first class people look at you sometimes, or they don't look at you. Like they don't want to make eye contact. It's like, get to the back, cattle, get to the back of the plane. Right. And then, you know, you get back there in your economy seat, right, and you're all tucked in. And then the stewardess, I hate this, they come and take the curtain, you know, and they kind of look at you back in economy like, if you just worked a little harder, right? And then that's the end of it. So all the first class people are standing up there and they're ready to get on the plane. But I'm okay because I've got my coffee and I've got my muffin. I'm ready to go. But about that time, a police officer passes kind of by me, and he walks up to the gate desk, and he's got a roll-on bag with him. And as he passes me, I think, man, that looks a whole lot like my roll-on bag. And I had gotten distracted, right, with my coffee and I'd left my roll-on bag. So he walks up by the gate check desk in front of all the people, all the first-class passengers who are there, and he turns around and he says, somebody forgot their bag. That's the code for moron forgot their bag this morning. And all the first class passengers are like, come on, rookie, you know. And so I've got to walk up there and get my bag. But all of a sudden they get all sweaty, right? I'm clammy because I don't want to walk up there in front of all the first class passengers and go admit that I'm the guy that forgot his bag, right? But I know if I don't go get my bag, I mean, I've got to have my bag, obviously, on the plane. But if I don't go now, he's just going to yell again, and it's just going to draw more attention to it, right? So do I go? Do I not go? I'm getting all sweaty, you know? And finally, I think, you know, there are moments in life where you just got to man up. So I walk up there and I'm like, yeah, that's my wife's bag. So I take it. No, I didn't do that. I'm just kidding. Some of you are looking at me like, liar, pastor, he's a liar. I didn't do that. But it's easy, isn't it, to get distracted. And when it comes to this value, it's so easy for us to get distracted by our own lives and our focus on ourselves. And so as we look at the Sermon on the Mount again today, we've been looking at various passages. The Beatitudes are kind of the introduction to the Sermon on the Mount. And the passage that we're going to look at today is right out of the gates, right after the Beatitudes. So if I can say it to you this way, this passage, albeit very familiar, is the first point of the first, maybe the most well-known, we'll say it that way, the most well-known sermon ever preached. So I think that makes our text this morning very important from Matthew chapter 5, and it's verse 13. We'll start in verse 13. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and to be trampled underfoot. Now, as salt, this is a metaphor that Jesus uses. As salt, you and I, we are seasoning. Not about you, I'm a saltaholic. Have been ever since when I was a kid, I used to salt a salt shaker in the palm of my hand and just eat it. Straight salt. Salt is essential, right, to life. Different world in Jesus' day. I'm going to show you a picture of the Dead Sea. That's where they, in Jesus' world, they collected salt. The Dead Sea is about 33%. It's about one-third salt. And so you're going to have salt deposits up on the edge of the, kind of up on the edge of the Dead Sea. And what's going to happen, what you're going to see any second, any second, is you're going to see all the white salt that's there. But you see how it's kind of mixed in with some brown stuff. That brown stuff is called gypsum. Gypsum is a mineral, and gypsum neutralizes salt. And so what would happen is they would go out, they would gather salt, and sometimes they would get too much gypsum in it. And the gypsum would cause the salt to lose its saltiness, to not taste like salt. And so whenever they got some bad salt or salt that had a lot of gypsum, it was only good for one thing. They would take it out and throw it on their roads and trample it underfoot because it would kill plant life, which is where we got our term for road salt. Not really, but that would have been really cool, wouldn't it? If that would have worked out that way. Pastor liar again, he's lying. That's what they did. They would throw it out, they would trample it underfoot, and it would kill the grass. Now, when Jesus says that you and I are salt, when he uses this metaphor, how are we salt? What does that mean? Here's what I think Jesus is trying to say. We live in a world of extremes. And in some ways, the church exists in a culture of extreme optimism and pessimism. What I mean by that, if you and I were alive 120, 150 years ago, coming out of the period of the Enlightenment, we would have thought everything's great. We would have thought everything's just going to get better and better and better. We're going to get smarter and smarter and smarter. And we're going to have a perfect kind of a utopian society. As a matter of fact, I'll give you a quote here from a guy who lived about 120 or so years ago. He's one of the major culture shapers over in Britain and Europe. His name's H.G. Wells. I'll put his picture up here, but let me read you this quote from H.G. Wells. Can we doubt that our race will presently realize our boldest imaginations, peace in a world more lovely than any garden or any palace ever known, from strength to strength in an ever-widening circle of achievement? That came from H.G. Wells and his epic mustache there. He said, hey, everything's just going to get better and better and better. We're going to get smarter and smarter and smarter, better than any garden or any palace that's ever been built. Let me give you another quote from H.G. Wells. 20 years after he made that quote, just after World War I, H.G. Wells said this, Homo sapiens, as he calls himself, has played out, and his depravity has come nearer to breaking my spirit. See, at one point it was all extreme optimism. Everything's great. And then all of a sudden, it became unbelievable pessimism. I'll give you another example. In the 1860s, there was a guy from Britain who wrote a short story. It was about a group of British schoolboys who got shipwrecked on an island, and they rebuilt their society on this desert island all by themselves. And it was, again, like a utopian community, this paragon of virtue. And 100 years later, in the 1960s, another British author, a guy named William Golding, writes the exact same storyline. A group of British schoolboys get shipwrecked on a desert island and they have to rebuild their society, except in this book, they hunt, kill, and cannibalize each other. It's called Lord of the Flies. In 100 years, culture, Western culture, had gone from this extreme optimism to this extreme pessimism. And honestly, that's kind of where we are still today. We don't trust anybody. We don't trust politicians or parents or pastors. I mean, we don't trust nobody. I can predict the 11 o'clock news tonight. You can just go turn it on. I'm going to tell you what. There's going to be the lead story. It's going to be something about a murder or an arson, probably. And then there'll be something on there about sexual immorality, and then there'll be something on there about a crooked politician, and that all may be the first story, right? That just may be the one story packed right there into one, and then there's going to be something on there about a food that we always have thought was good for us, but all of a sudden now it's terrible for us, and it's killing all of us, right? And you watch the news, and you walk away depressed. And listen, you may be here today, you may not be a Christian, you may not be a believer, and you say, you know what, I don't believe in all that stuff. But you cannot disagree with me, right, on this point. If an alien, right, never been to the planet, plops down here tonight, turns on the 11 o'clock news, what's he going to think? This world's falling apart. And you know what? He's right. Think about your life. Not just, you know, we talked about arts and sciences, maybe there a little bit, but think about your life relationally. Do relationships tend to just grow together and become better and better and better? No. Relationships take work. Relationships come apart. You ever try and get people to work together, people from different ethnic backgrounds or different races or different social strata? You ever try and get people to work together? Man, if you don't stay on that thing and communicate and communicate and communicate and serve and serve and serve, before long, man, people are mad at each other and angry at each other, and that whole thing's coming apart. Think about marriage. Marriage takes work. The greatest relationship in the world, it takes tons and tons of effort and time and energy and work. Why? Because things relationally tend to fall apart. Think about your body. Don't think about relationally. Think physically. How's your body doing these days? Better and better and better? Now our bodies are coming apart. I mean, with all of our medical advances, and listen, I'm all for it, all for the care, the wisdom that God's given doctors and all the new drugs we've developed and pharmacology. I'm all for all of it. But with all of our medical advances, the death rate is exactly what it's always been. One death per person, right? It hasn't changed for thousands and thousands of years. What are we saying? Listen, whether it's relationally or physically or artistically in the sciences, this world's coming apart at the seams, and there's this deep sense, this foreboding sense of pessimism. And I think what Jesus is saying in this passage is that you and I are to be salt to that, that neutralizes the blah pessimism that exists in the world. But not just salt. He gives us another metaphor in verses 14 and 15. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on a stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. Now, as salt, we're seasoning, but as light, we are revealing. The word that's used here in the passage is actually the word lamp. So really what it says is you are the lamp of the world. And you say, well, why is that a big deal? Well, a couple of times in the Gospels, Jesus says that he is the light of the world. And a couple of times, or at least whenever he said it, got him into a lot of trouble. This is a Jewish menorah. And the word menorah comes from the word Moriah in the Old Testament. Mount Moriah. The Jews believe that God spoke to Moses through a burning Moriah bush. And so because the bush grows up out of the ground and kind of flowers out, they structured the Jewish menorah like this. And in the temple, right? In the temple, they had this thing called the lampstand. And it was lit perpetually. It was an eternal flame that reminded them of God's presence. It was a reminder to them that God never sleeps. God never goes away. He's always with them. So in John 8, whenever Jesus waltzes into the temple, and I think he kind of maybe stands close, and he says, I'm the light of the world. This eternal flame, that's me. All of a sudden, they try to kill him. So you and I are lamps. We don't produce light. We carry the light of the world, the light of the gospel that has been lit on the inside of us. There's a unique phenomenon over in the Eastern Hemisphere that's, for a lot of people, is on their bucket list to go visit. It's in New Zealand in a place called Waitomo. And a lot of people, travelers, will come specifically make a route through there. And I'll show you a series of pictures. But let me show you the first one. People want to go see that. You know what those are? Those are real glowworms. And they hang in these caves in Waitomo. And what happens is you get in a boat with some other people and a guide, kind of like almost like a gondola, right, takes you through these caves. And you're like, really? To see that? Well, let me show you what it looks like on the top of a cave. And then let me show you what this light can do in a huge cave. And people from all around go to see these. You know what's unique about these glowworms? They live 24 hours. That's a big day. You've got to be born, find a mate, have a kid, and die all in 24 hours in one day. That's what they do. They're alive 24 hours. They flame as hot as they can, bright as they can burn. You know what the New Testament says in 1 Peter? It says that with the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is like one day, 24 hours. What's the Apostle Peter trying to say to us? Saying compared to eternity, beginning of time to end of time, rest of your existence, this few years that you live on this planet is like one small day. You are the light of the world. All you've got down here is one day. Burn out. Flame out. Jesus says, for the sake of the gospel. You say, well, how do I do that? What do I do? Jesus doesn't leave us hanging. Look down in verse 16. Here's what he says. In the same way, let your light shine before others that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father who's in heaven. See, what salt and light do is that salt and light display beauty. Remember that core value of global responsibility. It's about thinking outwardly, not inwardly. Salt and light are all about thinking outwardly. You know, the weather's been pretty the last couple of days. We start thinking about summer. We start thinking about nights sitting on the back patio, maybe getting the grill out. And maybe one night you're going to eat some corn on the cob. You're going to butter it and salt it. And that first ear of corn of the summer, you're not going to bite into that with that first bite and go, man, that is good salt. Right? The salt brings out the flavor of the corn. The salt is not for itself. Think about, you're going to see that first sitting on the back patio, you're going to watch the sun go down for the first time, and what photographers and videographers call the magic hour, where the sun, the light is just right, everything's lit up beautifully. You don't look up at the sky and go, man, that's some great light. No, because the light reveals the beauty that's in the heavens. I think what Jesus is saying to you and me is we're light. You're light, whether you want to be light or not. The question is, are you good light or bad light? You ever wake up early in the morning and you've got to get navy blue socks? But you know, in mixed with the navy blue socks in your drawer, there are black socks, right? And so you get them out and you start squinting and you can't really tell. And so you got to go somewhere else where there's what? Good light, right? Because good light reveals color. There are two words for good in the Greek language. Agathos, which means good in quality. And the other word is kalos, where we get our word for color, which means beautiful. And the word that Jesus uses in this passage is kalos. See, we are salt and light to what end? That we live out beautiful deeds. That people would see the beautiful deeds that we live out. And that draws glory and attention, not to us, but to our Father who's in heaven. What does that mean? That means that in every way, you and I have been created to be His. And our lives are about thinking outwardly to the degree that our lives reveal the beauty of who God is in the world. It's not shoving Christianity down somebody's throat. But your life should reveal the beauty of how life ought to be. From God's perspective, your life should show promiscuity to be promiscuity. Your life should show racism to be racism. It should show office gossip to be office gossip. Exactly what it is. How you treat the people who are kind of under you on the org chart at work should reflect on the beauty of who God is. Your interactions with other people, how you date, how you think about your future, it should all display the beauty and the glory of God. It should fight against the blah pessimism of the world, and it should reveal the beauty that is in the creation of God, the image of God that's in all of us. Now, there's a hundred or more ways we could apply this message this morning, but I'm going to give you two that are real practical, and honestly, they're practical to us, to those of us who call LifePoint Church our home. The first one is about a project that we started about 10 months ago called Next Door. And as we talked and prayed together last year, we talked about this whole idea of what's next in our future as a church. We prayed and we sensed God saying to us that our next door to walk through was literally next door, right over there. There's a business over there that occupies about 15,000 square feet of space, and they were going to be moving. And we said, okay, our next step is to kind of grow into that space. We got about 20,000 square feet here. We're going to move into that 15,000. And so we gave to that. We prayed towards that end about, I don't know, probably three months later, we had a contract, ready to sign it. But when we were ready to sign it, one of the partners in the business over there passed away suddenly. So the estate all got caught up in litigation and probated and how's all this going to work out? And all of a sudden, everything just went to a screeching halt. And we thought, well, okay, it'll be another week. And another week turned into another month, and another month turned into another month. And so by the end of the year, we're waiting. But right before Christmas, one day, we were here in the offices at church, and these two Irish guys show up. Now, they say, hey, we represent the majority ownership of this building. Now, we've never met them before. They didn't make an appointment. I guess when you own a building, you don't have to make an appointment. They just showed up one day. They're potato farmers who own some holdings around the world, and this is one of their holdings, I guess. So they just roll in here one day. So we go out, say hello, and meet them. And basically what they said to us is, you don't need to just take in that 15,000 square feet there, but you also need to take in 15,000 square feet on the other side of the space that we have. We think you need all. They said, your church is growing. You need all of the space. They were Irish guys who talked with really bad Welsh accents, okay? Just work with me. Work with me. So here's what we did. I mean, we know, right, God doesn't speak with an Irish accent, but we got our ministry leadership team together, and we thought, hey, maybe there's something divine in this delay. And we didn't think we could pay for all of that space and all of that space, but we started praying about it. And so as of today, here's kind of where we've landed on the Next Door project. I'm going to show you a drawing up here of what that space could look like. By the way, these drawings, there are copies of these out in the lobby. If you want to grab one after church, you're more than welcome to do that. Currently, this is the space we've occupied here to here. So this wall, this line right here, that is that wall on the back side. So originally in the Next Door project, I'm standing kind of right here. You're sitting right here. We were going to knock this wall down and go this way, right? Going to be more space for students. We're going to not occupy office space, blah, 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 blah. Well, as we've prayed and thought about it, what we realized in the process is that 5,000 extra square feet down here would keep us balanced in terms of adults and children. So what we've been able to do with this 5,000 square feet is we've added a couple more baby rooms here for moms and dads whenever they show up, and more rooms for ones and twos. This is the new larger Jump City. This is now going to become big time for preschoolers. This whole room here is going to be for Double Jump. I think it's going to be for fourth and fifth graders. Where these offices are in the front over here, you know, where this all kind of gets clogged up, all of those are going to be taken out and check in now. See, you'll be up here, and we kind of widen these hallways and areas. Again, the room for students over here, offices are up front. And that's kind of what we've sensed as far as a ministry leadership team. I know we had a number of our ministry leadership team members in the 9:30 service. If you're on the ministry leadership team and you're here, there, would you raise your hand? Everybody look around. See who's on the. There's David that's up here. We got one back there. As we prayed together, what we sensed God saying was, you need to do that. So we're actually going to double our square footage here in this space. So here's what I've got this morning. I am so excited that as of this week, here is a signed contract. Finally, after 10 months. Yeah, you can clap for that. On our new space here in this facility. Looks like we're going to start construction right around the last few days of May, first few days of June. But here's what that did. Adding that extra 5,000 square feet of space for kids, it added some cost to our project. All the money that you gave towards Next Door over the last 10 months is sitting right there in an account ready to be used. That extra 5,000 square feet of space there on the south side is going to cost about $190,000. Now, our landlord's going to participate and help some. That cut the cost down to about $157,000. We've saved up some money in that time, so that cuts our cost down to about $113,000 is the gap that we have between what current resources we have and what we need. We need about another $113,000. So we prayed about that as a team. And we said, you know what? Here's what we could do. We could go out and we could go to a bank and we could borrow $113,000 to finish off the project. But honestly, that's not really been our MO to this point. We haven't had to borrow anything. We haven't been in debt. We'd rather not do that. So here's what we decided. We decided we're going to come to you as the body, as the church. And we're going to ask you to pray about giving over the next 4 months to see that gap completed. Now, what does that look like? How do you make that practically work in your life? Well, maybe here's one way to think about it. Our children's pastor, Mark Shields, who did the bad dance earlier when he was up here, Mark says that with that extra 5,000 square feet of space, that we can accommodate another 400-ish kids between two services on Sunday morning. So when you do the math on that, it kind of breaks down like this. That's about $300 per child, whether that's a baby or a preschooler, a school ager in Jump City, fourth grade, fifth grade, whatever you want to think about it, Next Generation Ministries, think in light of your student, providing space for your students, about $300 per child. So I'm going to ask you to pray about that. Now, is everybody going to be able to give $300? No, probably not. Can some of us give more for the folks who aren't here yet? Yeah, because see, that represents preschoolers that aren't here yet, that are friends with your kids right now. That represents moms and dads that you meet in Chick-fil-A who have kids who just moved to town, who don't yet have a church family. That represents school-agers in Jump City who not only go to Jump City, but then have the opportunity and jump back to turn around and then go and serve others. The same with fourth and fifth graders. It represents families who show up almost now on a weekly basis. Families who have special needs kids who connect with our You Are Special team. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago over on the other side. So I'm just going to ask you to pray about giving towards that, about being part of what God is doing here in the life of our church and our church family. I'll be excited to watch this process go throughout the summer and the extra space be added and all the extra parking that's going to be added around the building, the parking spaces to accommodate all of this. But I'm just going to ask you as a church family that we pray together. You say, well, Dean, why are you spending so much time talking about this? Well, that's the second thing I wanted to talk to you about. I said there was two ways we could apply it. And the second way that I feel like we can apply this idea of being salt and light is that next Sunday's Easter. More people will go to church just for cultural reasons, if no other reason, next Sunday than any other Sunday in our country. And there is nothing like getting the opportunity to be part of seeing somebody cross the line of faith. There's nothing like it. I've got a friend. His name is Eldon Gaston. We met in 1992. I was on spring break. I was going to Ohio State at the time. I was on spring break with some of my buddies down there, and we were at Daytona Beach. And so we were doing kind of a Bible study thing down there. And somehow, some way, Eldon gets somehow connected to this thing we're doing, and he shows up at the Bible study that we're doing that night. And for him, that night was his moment. That night was the night that he crossed the line of faith, that he applied the sacrifice of Jesus to his heart, and that was the night for Eldon that he became a Christian. And he and I have remained friends. He was actually crazy. He was from Columbus in transition, moving to Florida at the time now today, lives in Florida. And Eldon is one of those guys, when you're around him, he is one of the most passionate Christians. He teaches multiple classes at his church on Sunday and leads people. And the thing that for me is, it's just a joy. It's a unique blessing that God has given to me. That anytime I'm able to hang around Eldon a little bit, whenever he's in Columbus, he'll come to church here. Or a couple of times I've been to Florida and been with him. You know, whenever I meet one of his friends and he introduces me, here's how he introduces me. He says, "Hey, this is Dean. He's the guy who brought me to Jesus." And I got to tell you, it never gets old. I look for people to meet. Hey, can we go meet him? So you can say that again. Why? Because it's just a joy. It should be so much part of who we are as Christians. And it happens a lot here. A couple of months ago, I was driving out to 23 after church was over on Sunday. And all of a sudden, my phone starts blowing up. And one of you texted me and said, "It happened. Today was the day. My sister did it today. She prayed to receive Christ today." And what a joy it is to get to be part of seeing people take that step. And to be honest with you, I don't know. I can't predict that there'll be more people who'll take that step next Sunday than any other Sunday, but there sure will be a lot of them. So what does that mean for you and me? That means this week we need to be prayed up, read up in the Word, and we need to be aware of what God is doing around us and take the opportunity to invest in somebody else's life and to invite them. Maybe you'll have the opportunity to invite them to a relationship with Christ right then and there. Maybe you have the opportunity to invite them here to come to Easter services next Sunday. Why do we do all that? Because you are the salt of the earth. And if you don't, if you're not the salt that you're supposed to be, if I'm not the salt I'm supposed to be, I am good for nothing. Just to be thrown on the road and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. All you've got down here, compared to eternity, is just a little day. Listen, be lit up for the glory of God. And somewhere along the way, God graces you. Somewhere along the way, there'll be somebody that you get to have a part and you get to see. And somebody will say, hey, this is Danny. And Danny was the one who introduced me to Jesus. Hey, this is Brian. And Brian was the one who introduced me to Jesus. This is Faith. And Faith was the one who introduced me to Jesus. Be salt and light. Reveal the glory of God for the beauty of what it is. Not because your life is about you thinking inwardly, but you're going to think outwardly for the glory of God. Let's pray together.